it on his mind.
Okay. There's a heart.
Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Ooh, your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
Kooks, it's good to see you again. It's been a long while, I know. This is Adam from Chicago Unbelievable and Mysterious Chicago, and originally the Weird Chicago podcast, if you remember way back there, all the various companies I've worked for over the years. So the dirt of gossip blows into my face and the dust of rumors covers me. It is true, I am no longer with Chicago Hauntings. I broke away from them at the end of the Halloween season, and now I have started my own, which is called Mysterious Chicago Tours. It's going to be branching out into all kinds of things beyond just ghost tours. We've got grave robbing tours. We've got tours of the weirder side of Little Italy, Civil War tours, hanging tours, gangster tours, ghost tours as well, but all kinds of stuff. And we're going to be launching a new podcast to go with that, too. There's actually two different radio shows that are about to be started. One is the Mysterious Chicago podcast, which you can already get now. If you follow all the links or check it out on iTunes or just go to mysterioushicago.com, you can get started on a whole new podcast that I promise to update a lot more frequently than I've done this one, especially the last year or so. Also, Hector and I have been offered our own radio show on an actual regular terrestrial radio station. It's going to be called The Derelict Theater. It's going to be a combination of talk, special guests, and live original radio drama. You can check that out at derelicttheater.com. That should be opening up very, very soon. So really, this is kind of the end of the Chicago Unbelievable podcast, and because of that, I thought I'd go through all the previous episodes and comment on the updates on the stories that have come in the few years since they were originally recorded. And then at the end of it, I got a special treat for you guys, especially for the ghost fans out there. I know there are quite a few who listen in here. Quite a lot of new stuff to talk about. Our first episode in this one, 5 years ago now, was back at Bachelor's Grove Cemetery when Hector and I went out there. Now, I don't have a lot of good new information about Bachelor's Grove. It's the same place it ever was. It's kind of our ghost hunting theme park of a cemetery down on the south side. Always meeting interesting people there. The people that you meet there are way more interesting than any of the ghosts. Now, when I was doing research for my book, The Ghosts of Chicago, which came out a while ago, I actually did manage to track down an interview, Judy Huff Feltz, who took the famous girl on the gravestone photograph there. I will say nothing she said ever made me think that she had faked the whole thing. Bachelor's Grove, I feel like I've talked so much about that place. Now, I do get lost in the woods there a lot. Every time I wander in the woods around that cemetery, I manage to get lost. It's not even a very big woods. But then again, when I talk about this, you know, I will literally have people tell me that there are fairies in those woods who are deliberately confusing me. I don't really know how to react to that kind of thing, really, even after all of these years. Moving on, one I know a little more how to deal with better is a Hull House. Hull House was a stop on my very first ghost tour 10 years ago now. It's was a stop on my most recent ghost tour just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, this is you're going to be hearing this months after the fact.
Well, but partly just because I feel like I have to clear up some of the stuff about this place. I mean, I know of ghost tour guides who tell people that after the Battle of Fort Dearborn, the Potawatomi gathered on the grounds where Hull House now stands to perform a ghost dance to curse the white man. And I don't even know where to begin saying what's wrong with that. The ghost dance movement came way, way after the Battle of Fort Dearborn. If they cursed the white man there, you got to remember Jane Addams won a Nobel Peace Prize while she was working there, so it wouldn't have been that competent of a curse, really. Also, I heard all these stories about abortion wells on the grounds and abortion graveyards and portals and things that people have really just made up over the years and nobody's doing any fact-checking on. But here's something. I found something new very recently. Now, we do know that Mrs. Hull, Mellicent Hull, died inside of that place. There's been stories off and on of Mrs. Hull haunting the place for quite a long time. Now, Charles Hull himself actually did say that he didn't believe in some far-off heaven for the scientific reason that the distance was too great. He believed that the spirits of the departed were still nearby us just for sheer matters of physics. And he was a bit of a spiritualist. I don't think he was a real hardcore seance-holding spiritualist, but he probably went to a seance now and then. Possibly held a few of his own. But just recently, I came up with this thing. I found this thing at the University of Chicago Library System, an 1867 pamphlet about a 50-page book called A Sketch of the Life of Charles. And That was really fascinating to see. I found quite a bit. There's a book by Charles Hull that's really most of the excerpts from his diary that you can get at two libraries in the city, have it in special collections. And it's a very interesting read, and it talks a little bit about his thoughts when Mellicent died in the house and a bit about his thoughts when Charlie, his son, died in the house. But it failed to clear up exactly what Mrs. Hull had died of. I could never find anything that told how Mrs. Hull died. But in this 1867 pamphlet, it does specify that she died of consumption, which is what they called tuberculosis in those days. It was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, killers of the 19th century, really. So we do have that bit of data now. And now this is kind of going to be a downer, I'm afraid. But also in the pamphlet, it also had a poem by Mellicent Hull. It's a poem called To Lewis. It was written to on the death of her son, Lewis Kossuth Hull, who died a couple of years before they moved into Hull House. So this would have been the pre-Hull House era. This poem went, To Lewis. I'm sad and lone without thee now, my beautiful bright boy. Thy cherub smile forever gone, embitters every joy. Thy baby innocence and glee with sunlight filled our home. 'Tis dark and dreary now, my love, thy little sports are done. I miss thee at thy morning's dawn when thy sweet dove-like voice awoke our happy household band and made each heart rejoice. When thy father sprang to clasp his boy and thy brother followed there, and thy little sister with the rest strove to thy first kiss to share. I miss thee in the lonely night from off my waiting arm, and vainly strive to clasp thee tight and shield thee from all harm. No more I feel thy golden head against my heart at rest, no more thy velvet cheek and hand upon my bosom pressed. No more I list to hear thy breath or try the pulse's might to see if nature's little car is moving on all right. And oh, how lone and desolate to feel thou art not near, and weep with broken heart to know thou'dst ne'er be again be here. Each childish face and form I see to catch one look of thee, then turn with sickening soul and say, it is not thee. I close my eyes and task my brain until my sense grows wild to see if some delusion fair will not recall my child. I know those large and sunlit eyes, their luster have all shed, and thy little angel form lies mouldering with the dead. I know the grave contains the whole that's earthly now of thee. The mansion where thy spirit dwelt is hid no more to see. The little chair where thou didst sit the morning that thou died, the cradle where their spirit fled are standing side by side. The little wardrobe leaned with care while tears were streaming free, with a precious lock of sunny hair are all that's left of thee. I thought ere long thy mind and form to manhood's might would rise, and with judicious nurturing to see thee good and wise, I thought when weary life declined on thy strong arm to rest, and in thy high and noble deeds to be supremely blessed. But oh, the lovely chain is broke, bright hopes with thee have fled, and oh, the bitter lesson learned of human hope and pride. Think not, my darling little son, thy form which was so fair is slumbering in the grave alone, thy mother's heart is there. Wow. This is one of those situations, even I don't have anything smart-alecky to say about this. That's just devastating. Devastating. Mrs. Hull herself would also die just a couple of years after she wrote that. She died in 1860, again, of tuberculosis. A few years later, Charlie Hull, her other son, who is mentioned in the poem, died at the age of 19, it mentions in this, of the cholera. The cholera got him. So I got to move on to a lighter note here. Our next one after that, we did another Hull House one. The next one was in Chaplin's Vault. The next episode was when we went to the old SNA studios. Now, interesting thing, this Michael G. Smith and I, Michael Glover Smith, were starting work on a book about silent film in Chicago way back when we first recorded that years ago. That book came out this year. It is called Flickering Empire, How Chicago Invented the U.S. Film Industry. That was published by Wallflower Press, the film studies branch of University of Columbia Press, this past January. And it was all over the news. We got to do speaking gigs for it all over the place. We're still giving lectures about it now. We've got another one booked coming up here in a couple of months. It's been a lot of fun. The whole silent film in Chicago thing was just a story waiting to be told. At SNA Studios, which we went to on that podcast, we're going to be using that sometime this winter. When we first were writing that book, one of the things that we talked about in the book was the SNA version of Sherlock Holmes that was made in 1916. That was the first Sherlock Holmes movie that was ever made, back in 1916, starring William Gillette. And as far as we knew at the time, it was lost. Nobody knew about a copy of it anywhere. It was not known to have survived. Like most Chicago silent films, it was thought to be long lost. But somebody found a copy of it in a vault in France last year. And we're working on an event with Atlas Obscura now. Atlas Obscura is a company that I'm doing most of my new tours through. We're going to be doing an event where we're going to screen Sherlock Holmes at SNA Studios right where it was actually filmed. Follow MysteriousChicago.com. Get on our mailing list. We'll keep you up to date on what's going on with that. I'm still kind of knocked out by the poem back there. It still feels weird to talk about anything happy at this point. This is why I try to keep the mood light and flippant on my tours most of the time. I think it's fantastic, though, that 150 years after that was written, we can still find that in a library and still share that. And that's what I like about my job. Some of the paranormal stuff kind of bothers me sometimes. People start talking to me about, like there's an invisible person in their basement that they need to show up with the right herbs and spices to get them to float away. I feel like it's a bad idea to encourage people to think like that. There's a lot of, like, discouraging people from checking their sources that goes on in the ghost lore world. A lot of encouraging people to reach straight for the supernatural explanation when something happens that they don't understand. And that's, I think it's irresponsible sometimes. It's dangerous even. But now and then we also can find these things like a 150-year-old beautiful poem like that and be able to share it with people, even after all this time. The next episode after that was Grave Robbing in Lincoln Park. We went out with Dan Krause, remember that, to the Old City Cemetery to talk about grave robbing. That's actually one of my new tours that I've been doing. I did one for Atlas Obscura last month, the Grave Robbing 101, where I teach you all of the tricks of the trade. Everything you need to know to launch your career as a 19th century body snatcher. And I am pro-grave robbing. Or at least I was in the 19th century, or it would have been if I had lived then. There was even a situation in the in the Old City Cemetery, which is now Lincoln Park. A guy's body was robbed. He had died after being, after having his leg amputated, and grave robbers stole his corpse and sold it to a medical school. And after they were caught, you know, there was a big public furor, but somebody pointed out, you know, if the doctor who had amputated his leg had had more practice, more bodies to practice on, maybe the guy wouldn't have died in the first place. This was very important. They needed every body they could get. So, yeah, I'm kind of on their side, really. I've read enough defenses. They're not incorrect. Moving along, we did a lot more Lincoln Park stuff as well. H.H. Holmes and the Great Glass Bending Factory. Now, the body dump site, what we call the body dump, where Holmes had what he said was a glass bending factory, was a regular stop on my ghost tours for a long time. There's been some construction there since, and since then it's a lot harder to get a bus out there, so I haven't been going as frequently. But lots of weird things happened there over the years. It had kind of quieted down, except for the fact that after this podcast was recorded, we did start getting interesting pictures out there. We started getting pictures of silhouettes that should not have been there. So that was very interesting, I thought. Now, we still don't have a whole lot more information about what the glassbending factory was like there. We've got enough data to understand for sure that Holmes did have a building there that he said was a glassbending factory. He started several such facilities, really. This was by far the largest, though. It would be estimated the furnace would have been about 150 feet long. Now, Holmes had no idea how to bend glass. We found accounts of people who watched him try to demonstrate glass bending and were completely unimpressed. So there's kind of a short list of things that a known multi-murderer would have been doing with a 150-foot-long furnace. We don't really know what happened with H.H. Holmes' bodies, the bodies of his victims. There was one skeleton they found in the basement. The other Chicago ones, we really don't know. There was a guy who showed up at the castle when the police were investigating it and said, "I used to buy dead bodies from this guy to turn into skeletons." His name was Myron G. Chapel. Books always called him Charles Chapel. The newspapers did that for a day before they corrected their mistake. The problem with that is, though, the guy's story didn't really hold water. When they checked into it, he had his names and dates were hopelessly confused. None of the medical schools that he said that he sold bodies to had ever heard of him. They had paperwork to prove it. So it's one of those things, exactly what happened. There are all these stories about lime pits and acid pits down in the basement, and most of them really just come out of tabloids and pulps. There was kind of a thing when they were first investigating that building where there was a week like, "We found a rope. He must have been hanging people. We found ashes in the wood-burning stove. Maybe he was cremating people in them." And then somebody would point out that, you know, you can't cremate somebody in a wood-burning stove. You can try, but you're not going to get any success with that. You're just going to get a scorched-up body. So we don't really know. So for all we know, he could have been burning up bodies at this glass-bending factory. The fact that they found anything there at all shows that they found about as much as they did at the Murder Castle site, really. Next one after that was the Resurrection Mary Roundtable. We talked about Resurrection Mary with Dale Kaczmarek of the Ghost Research Society and Ray Johnson, the haunt detective. And I love talking about Resurrection Mary. What's interesting about her is when people tell the story of Resurrection Mary, they're usually just telling the basic legend of the vanishing hitchhiker. It's always said to be a woman that they met at the ballroom. Then when they go to the woman's house, she's disappeared. And the mother says, "That can't have been my daughter. She died years ago." They find out the story of a girl who had a fight with her boyfriend coming home from from prom. Sometimes there's a sweater left on her grave. When you break it down to the Resurrection Mary sightings, the sightings of our vanishing hitchhiker in Chicago, most of that stuff isn't really present. All the stuff about meeting her in a ballroom, all the stuff about going to her mother's house, that's why we don't know who she is anymore. People don't really do that much. When you break it down to the first-hand sightings, what you see mostly is people saw a girl by the side of the road, she got in the car for a couple of blocks, and then she was gone. That's a lot of that other stuff is just people telling the vanishing hitchhiker legend. It's, most of the stories aren't really based on the first-hand sightings, but we do have first-hand sightings. And that makes it a little more interesting to me than just a regular vanishing hitchhiker would be. The Dunning Cemetery. Now, here's something about Dunning Cemetery. One of my drivers on the tours, back when they still had their own bus at Chicago Hauntings, was Wendy Weaver. Wendy was awesome. Wendy was like the big sister I never wanted. She said that she didn't like going to Dunning because the one time she did, she felt a hand grabbing onto her ankle. And you got to remember, we talked about Johann Hawk, who they think had proposed to wife number 55 by the time they caught him. He probably killed about a third of those wives. He was buried out at Dunning. So I always like to imagine, at least, when Wendy was out there walking around Dunning Cemetery, felt a hand on her ankle, that was Johann going, ooh, 56. Moving on, inside the murder castle. That was a neat one. That was the time that I got to go down into the basement of the Englewood Post Office, which was built over at least a part of the site where the H.H. Holmes murder castle was, making me the envy of ghost hunters everywhere. Now, at the time, we were when the History Channel was filming what they said was going to be called Mystery Files at the time. By the time the show actually aired, it was a ghost hunting show called Haunted History. And I think the post office was upset about that. I think that might be why they're now cracking down on the place. They're certainly not letting people go in there for ghost hunting purposes now. There was going to be a talk. Jeff Mudgett, Holmes' great-great-grandson, who we interviewed back on the Glassbending Factory podcast, was putting together an A-team of paranormal investigators who were going to go inside of the place. But I guess the Postmaster General himself shut it down. Or at least that's the way that I heard the story. Italian Bride of Chicago at Mount Carmel. There's no new information about that that's going to be forthcoming at this point. We found a lot of really cool stuff about it. There's photographs of Philomena Bacola now. Lots of new findings that I was able to get in time for the book. Graceland Cemetery Safari. I'm actually going to be hopefully running a lot more walking tours at Graceland Cemetery. Now that I'm not specifically a ghost tour guide anymore, doing a lot more historical stuff, maybe I can start taking more walking tours through Graceland Cemetery. I hope so, because there's just so much to see out there. We can barely get started. Also, Rose Hill. We did a couple in a row at Rose Hill, or a couple over the course. Rose Hill is another one I hope I can do some things at. We still haven't solved the mystery of William Duvall, the supposed revolutionary soldier out there. It's not for lack of looking, but the information on that has seemed to have dried up. And, of course, one of my favorite ones we ever did was the geeking out over Mr. Couch one, where we went to Ira Couch's great-great-great-granddaughter digging through boxes of paperwork she has so we could try to figure out who is interred in Ira Couch's tomb. Ira Couch's tomb is the one tomb that is still left over at the Old City Cemetery in Lincoln Park. And for those who have only heard the first couple of episodes, maybe, we did get a little new information using some equipment called the Tomb Snooper 500, a really high-tech piece of equipment, which is an iPhone taped to a wire hanger. I did find out there was a crack underneath the door, so using the Tomb Snooper 500, I was able to get some pictures of what's behind the door of the couch tomb. It turns out that what's behind the door is another door. And so I kind of feel like I've gotten past level one, but not level two, but we're going to keep working on that one. But anyway, I promised you guys a special surprise at the end of this. 7 or 8 years ago now, I'm not really supposed to talk about this even now, but we got a lot of access back in one of my old companies. We managed to get a lot of access to several nights of investigating at the old theater where the Iroquois Theater was, where a fire in 1903 killed 600 people. It's the alley behind it has been a regular tour stop for me from day one. It's one of my favorite places to take people. Now, the theater does not allow ghost hunters in. Absolutely not. Most of these places really don't. They don't even like to talk about it here. But from some connections to a former employee there, I got to explore there quite a bit. And I love exploring these old buildings. Even if I don't expect a ghost to show up, you're apt to find all kinds of cool stuff inside of the place. You never know where you're going to find a hidden room. You're going to find, like, lip prints on the wall that are signed and dated by a vaudeville dancing troupe in the 1930s. Anyway, one of the stories about ghosts that go around there among the employees and the actors who are working there is they say that one of the dressing room toilets is known to flush all by itself, and every time it does, they hear the sound of a little girl giggling. Now, it's kind of an odd way for a ghost to manifest, flushing toilets and laughing about it. But this was, you know, the fire was 1903. Maybe it's a girl who had never seen a flush toilet before. Or also, there's a girl named Harriet Wolfe who died in the fire. Her grandfather was Ludwig Wolfe, whose tomb at Graceland Cemetery is supposed to be haunted. He was a plumbing supply salesman, so she has some connection to the toilet industry as well. But anyway, while I was wandering around one time, it wasn't actually in a bathroom. I never heard the toilet there flush by itself. But while I was wandering around one of the alcoves near the stage right area, I was walking around with an audio recorder running, and I did hear a giggling sound. And this didn't just turn up on the recorder, either. It was something people who were around could actually hear in the naked ear. I've never played that on a podcast, but I'm going to put it for you right now. This is about a 10-second clip. See if you hear a giggling sound right in the middle of it. All right, did you hear that? Again, just for reference, I heard that while I was walking around. People around me heard it with the naked ear. So it wasn't just something that showed up on the recorder later on. It probably wasn't just a mechanical noise from the recorder. Back in those days, I was still using mini disc. That's how long ago that was. But anyway, so this concludes the Chicago Unbelievable podcast. If you go to mysterioushicago.com, the new one has already started. I think in the new one, we're going to be doing a little more that we're just talking instead of organizing expeditions. We'll do some of that too, but I think this will allow me to do more podcasts rather than having to get everything organized so I can just sit down like this and tell a couple of good stories. So anyway, I'm going to leave you guys with one more thing. One quick plug for mysterioushicago.com. I've migrated the whole blog and everything over to there. You can still download all of the old podcasts there. And just to leave you, I'm going to play you the complete version of the theme song, Your Neighborhood Gives Me the Creeps. Enjoy, everybody.
Get on his mind.
Okay,
Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Ooh, your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
By him, he winks at me. The street lights make shadows to yawn. Long after daylight is gone, there are cackles and screams that come back in my dreams of the girl who hears all along. The neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
Station playing enough of the revolving door all-stars. Does your neighborhood give you the creeps? Have you been injured in an accident? Are you as constipated as I am? Because if so, you may be entitled to some great shit.